The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Excuse me. Today, we're going to talk in the second part of our program about the danger of mercury fillings. That's right, the silver fillings in your mouth are 52% mercury, and what we should do about it. So we're going to demand an end to mercury amalgam fillings in dentistry, and what kind of progress is being made. In addition, a commentary from Robert Shear. After summers comes the fall, from Truth Dig as well as Obama the Neoconservative, by Sheldon Richman, and from Counterpunch. The latest on health and healing, and a newsmaker update on where we stand on that food safety bill, and I'll give you the latest on that. So a lot to share. We won't have time for calls today, but we will tomorrow. A lot of people take antibiotics and times they take it for things that they do need, which is understandable, especially if they don't know that there is an alternative, natural approaches. But even if they were taking it for the right reasons, people overtake antibiotics. And as a result, it upsets their system and frequently causes resistant bacteria. Well, the latest study from the National Academy of Sciences Proceedings shows that even seemingly gentle antibiotics may severely disrupt the balance of microorganisms living in your gut with a lot of unforeseen health circumstances. Now, according to this latest study, women given Cipro, Flaxacin, showed the drug suppressed entire populations of good bacteria, and at least one woman took months to recover. And so this is serious when you consider how many people are taking this. Now, we're only talking about a five-day course, and that's generally what is taken. So be very careful, because you're going to end up having problems if you take these, especially if you don't at the same time take the good bacteria, the probiotics, which we should be taking on a daily basis no matter what. So the lesson is, two times a day, take your good bacteria. And try to stay away from antibiotics unless they're absolutely necessary. And then do your research in the physician's desk reference on side effects and efficacy of the particular antibiotic that your doctor is prescribing you. Cranberries. We know they're very good for helping to keep the bad bacteria from adhering to the walls of the bladder and hence causing bladder or urinary tract infections. New research, just published in the British Journal of Nutrition, done at Palaki University, shows that cranberries also are good for prostate. Now, this is a study done in the Czech Republic, and it says that, the quote, our trial is the first to evaluate cranberry in the treatment of lower urinary tract symptoms, specifically in men with benign prostatic hyperplasia and elevated PSA levels, and non-bacterial prostatitis. Unlike currently used medication for prostatitis, cranberry has no adverse effects. Our findings may assist men suffering from the condition and also their clinicians to decide on a treatment that is both inexpensive and natural like cranberry. Well, that's very good, considering that this is the British Journal of Nutrition, major peer-reviewed journal. So here is the idea. If taking cranberry, unsweetened cranberry juice, or concentrate or powder, could help you if you have bacterial infection in the bladder, and could help you if you have an enlarged prostate, then reason would suggest that we take it daily in order to prevent those conditions. So another natural non-toxic compound that we can take that helps us. Now, recently, I added watercress to a particular invention of mine. And because I've seen the scientific literature, here's something that I just read this morning, again from the scientific literature. This is from Professor Graham Packham of University of Southampton. And this was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. And he said the following, quote, watercress may turn off breast cancer mechanisms. This is really good stuff. It says a compound found in watercress may suppress breast cancer development by stopping the function of a protein important in tumor development. And this is a phenyl isothiocyanate, a compound found in watercress, as well as broccoli and cabbage, can block a key process in cancer's development by interfering with and turning off the function of a protein called hypoxia-inducible factor, HIF. Quote, the research takes an important step towards understanding the potential health benefits of this product, since it shows that eating watercress may interfere with a pathway that has already been tightly linked to cancer development. So that's good news. So your watercress, most people don't eat it. In fact, it's not the easiest thing to find in supermarkets, but it can help prevent breast cancer. And vitamin D, again linked to higher death rates in heart patients when you don't have enough of it. So low levels, deficiencies of vitamin D makes you more at risk for heart disease. And this is a study that, let me just cite the most important part of the study here. This was done at the University Medical Center in Groningen in the Netherlands. And it says, by showing that vitamin D is an independent predictor, we hope to prove that it is a contributory factor to rather than peripheral to the development and prognosis of heart failure. With this new information, we then hope to provide better insight into the pathophysiology of heart failure. Now, in lay language, what he is saying is this. When you have too little vitamin D, you're at greater risk of dying from all forms of heart disease. So that's why you should make sure that you get your, anywhere at the low end, 1,000, at the high end, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 units of vitamin D a day. It can make all the difference in the world. And also good news, if you're eating your vegetables or multiple vegetables, this is from Ethan Huff, and this was done at the University of East Anglia, and it says, vegetables are storehouses of vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and phytonutrients that help the body ward off and prevent disease. A recent study at the university has revealed that one such vegetable compound, known as sulforaphane, actually inhibits the function of destructive enzymes that cause arthritis. Several recent studies have linked cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and cauliflower with cancer prevention, but it appears these vegetables provide other useful benefits as well. Eating them causes blood levels of sulforaphane to increase, which may enter joint tissue and prevent destruction. Osteoarthritis is an arthritic condition where joint cartilage slowly degrades over time, causing severe pain. And, quote, laboratory studies show that sulforaphane may block an enzyme that triggers inflammation and joint pain. And this was in the Food Synergy. So that's good news. So that's good. And finally, vitamin D proven far better than vaccines in preventing influenza infections. And this is from Mike Adams, who has a program here on the Progressive Radio Network. If scientists discovered something that worked better than vaccines that prevent an influenza, you'd think they would jump all over it, right? After all, isn't the point to protect children and adults from influenza? A clinical trial conducted by the Division of Molecular Epidemiology in the Department of Pediatrics of Chike University School of Medicine in Tokyo found that vitamin D was extremely effective at halting the influenza infections in children. The trial appears in the issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. The results are from a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study involving 334 children, half of which were given 1,200 units a day of vitamin D3. In other words, this was a rigorous scientific study meeting the gold standard for scientific evidence. And what they found was that vitamin D was responsible for an absolute reduction in those getting the influenza. Flu vaccines, according to latest scientific evidence, achieve a 1% reduction in influenza symptoms. This means that vitamin D is 800% more effective than vaccines at preventing influenza infection in children. And to further support this, what really needs to be done is a clinical trial directly comparing vitamin D supplements to influenza vaccines and in four total groups. Group 1 receives vitamin D placebo. Group 2 receives vitamin D at 2,000 units a day. Group 3 receives an influenza vaccine. And group 4 receives an influenza a placebo vaccine. And then that's even better. But right now the science is in, and the science shows that vitamin D is better at helping your child than influenza vaccine. That's good news. Oh, one last thing. I mentioned about 6 months ago why pistachios were good for you. Well, this is the latest information. It's from Penn State University, published in the Journal of Nutrition, and it says, a diet high in pistachios can increase the level of disease-fighting antioxidants in your blood. Quote, our previous study showed the benefits of pistachios in lowering lipids and lipoproteins, which are a risk factor for heart disease. This new study shows an additional effect of pistachios, so now there are multiple health benefits for eating pistachios. So that's good. We already knew health benefits from walnuts, almonds, macadamia nuts, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, and now pistachios. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Recently, Kara Lee, our program director, who's in studio, asked me a question about what was the real cause, if we could focus on a cause. We've been led to believe the cause of our current crisis is a subprime meltdown because people got liar loans, people who shouldn't have had houses were the problem. And I said, no, the problem was that Ronald Reagan wanted to have the banking industry deregulated, and he was not able to do it. However, when Bill Clinton came into office, he went to Wall Street and he selected a man who was arguably one of the two or three most powerful men in the entire nation's financial system, Robert Rubin, and he was the CEO of Goldman Sachs. Rubin was a quiet man in disposition. He wasn't an in-your-face kind of person. So he brought a person who was an in-your-face person named Lawrence Summers. Now, Summers would then become Secretary of the Treasury, and as a result, he brought a protege, and that protege was a 35-year-old person, and his Timothy Geithner, who's now Secretary of the Treasury. So we had people who were all interconnected, but Wall Street, in effect, became our Treasury Department and our official financial policy. So behind the scenes all the time were these titans of industry, who themselves were interconnected with multiple corporations, board of directors, and major economic elite. Then one day, the three of them got together, meaning Timothy Geithner, and who's now our Treasury Secretary, and Lawrence Summers, and Rubin, and they were joined together with Alan Greenspan, the head of Federal Reserve, and they told Clinton, let's pass the Commodity Future Modernization Act. And that would just open up the floodgates to allow toxic mortgage-backed derivatives to just be used by anyone without regulation oversight at all. And they agreed. And Clinton signed that into law. At the same time, they said there's one regulation we've got to get rid of, and it will allow our economy on Wall Street to boom, and that is the Glass-Steagall Act. And that's what had been there protecting us since the 1930s. Again, Clinton, fully aware of the consequences, said, all right, because Clinton was a political heavyweight, but he was not an economic heavyweight. He was not an elite. Now, you might think, well, how is it the President of the United States could not be the most important person? All to the contrary. Let us be very clear, everyone. The President of the United States is really way down the food chain. I mean, he's not in the top 2,000 powerful people in the United States. Presidents come and go. They will come when they're wanted, and they'll go when they're not wanted. And afterwards, if they've done the bidding of the people, they become rich. They never become elite, but they become rich. Like right now, Bill Clinton, when he went into office, was worth about $800,000. Now he's worth about around $170 million. His foundation is up around $800 million. So he got his payback. Each one of them will get their payback. That's how it works. So these people are not stupid. Now, by doing what they did, they allowed the Wall Street to no longer invest in corporations and jobs in America, instead into these derivative positions. As a result, there was only one person who stood between them and total exploitation of the world economy, and that was a woman named Brooksley Bourne. Brooksley Bourne had been an attorney practicing in derivatives law for 20 years, and she was actually one of the people who was going to be Secretary of the Treasury. But instead, as a token, they gave her the head of this Commodity Exchange Commission. And she argued repeatedly in front of Congress, and you'll see this in my film on Greed Street, which is the working title of my film on Wall Street, which I'm still filming. You'll see Alan Greenspan, you'll see Robert Rubin, you'll see all these people, including Lawrence Summers, testifying, there's no problem, the industry should regulate itself, we see no downside, all the while they were allowing a bubble to be created. They threw her out of office, and that's what caused the absolute crash we're in today. So these very sophisticated financial institutions failed us. The people running them failed us. And that's how AIG crashed. That's how we ended up having to give $180 billion of our money to these financial institutions, who in turn gave $12 billion over to Goldman Sachs. And gee whiz, Goldman Sachs gave a lot of that to Lawrence Summers just in lecture fees. So everybody was fed, not the American consumer. And why do I mention this? Because of all the lessons to be learned, Bill Clinton did come back, to his credit, even though he was the architect who signed off on this. And on ABC's This Week, this past April, when asked by Jake Tapper if he had received bad advice from Summers and his predecessor Robert Rubin on regulating financial derivatives, he replies, quote, on derivatives, yeah, I think they were wrong, and I think I was wrong to take their advice, because the argument on derivatives was that these things are expensive and sophisticated, and only a handful of investors will buy them, and they don't need any extra protection and extra transparency, unquote. Well, that is the same Summers, Lawrence Summers, and same Timothy Geithner, and the same Robert Rubin who are around Barack Obama and who are dictating all the policy now. So if the people who got us into this mess and who've taken no personal responsibility are the ones currently advising this president, then what is the likelihood that they will do the right thing and get us out? They won't. So I just wanted to share that with you. And one other point I want to make before we go on here. I keep hearing, and I try wherever possible, even when I'm out of the country, I go to the internet radio because I want to hear what the arguments are and what their positions are. And I keep hearing all the people on the right call Barack Obama socialist and ultra-liberal. No, he's not. To the contrary. Barack Obama is absolutely, unequivocally, positively a neoconservative by every action he has taken. All you have to do is look at what he did. Did he actually give bailouts to American businesses? No. Did he stop home foreclosures? No. Did he stop the stop trading in derivatives? No. Did he curtail pharmaceutical profits? No. Did he allow Medicare, Medicaid, and VA to buy drugs at their least expensive price? No. Did he put a moratorium on those repossessions of cars? No. Did he start a process of hiring young people to work at Regreening America? No. Did he rebuild the actual infrastructure based upon local arrangements? No, he did not. Did he promote a war? Yes. Did he completely turn that war over to private contractors and without any accountability to the billions of dollars spent? Yes. Just to give you an example, this just came out today. Quote, U.S. fails to account for Iraq reconstruction billions. A U.S. federal watchdog group has criticized U.S. military for failing, quote, to account properly for billions of dollars. Now get this. The Inspector General's Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction says the U.S. Department of Defense is unable to account for $8.7 billion out of $9 billion. That's 96% of all the money given to Iraq for reconstruction they can't find. Don't know who's got it. Don't know where it went. Well, I'll tell you where it went. It's right now somewhere on the French Riviera in a mansion with a private jet. That's where it's at and all the other places. So look at it this way. Even if you looked at William Crystal, the editor of the Weekly Standard, he told a colleague that while he would have phrased the speech differently, quote, his basic response was, all hell Obama, meaning that Obama is on the sides of the neocons. Everything he's doing is all neocon. In fact, let me give you one example. This is the kind of person Obama hangs with. Frederick Kagan, one of the top neocon brains and the signatory of the Project of the New American Century Imperial Manifesto, guess who he now works for? General David Petraeus. So, take a look at Iraq today. It's a mess. It's a catastrophe because of what we've done there. So Obama propagates the neocon myth that Iraq was a great success. For whom? The military-industrial contractors? Yes. The Iraqi people? No. Americans who died or were injured? Gulf War Center post-traumatic stress disorder? Billions, hundreds, trillions of dollars lost? No. So, just remember, the next time you hear someone say, oh, he's a socialist, really? If he's a socialist, then he would have stood strong on having a single payer, and he wouldn't have allowed continuing funding in unlimited amounts of the military-industrial complex, nor would he have allowed rendition to occur, which is still occurring, torturing, waterboarding of prisoners, nor would he have allowed America to become a police state. No, he's a neocon. Put him right up there beside Paul Wolfowitz, but with a smile and with the capacity to read off a teleprompter better than any other president in history. I'm Gary Null. Let's go into studio and say hello to Kara Lee. Hi, Kara.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, Gary, I received this really interesting email from a retired major in the Marines, and it was just a little statement. I just wanted to read it to you. I thought you would enjoy it. He said that he is historically conservative. That's how he grew up, and he was in the Marines. And about 3 months ago, he started to tune into your station. One day he heard you do a commentary on the political parties and how both sides have it wrong. He said that it was an epiphany for him, and now he realized that he was part of the problem. He's since then become an independent, and one day he heard your background on vaccines. Later on, unfortunately, his grandson got 7 vaccines and became autistic. The doctors didn't want to accept that it was the vaccines, and now he does plenty of research on vaccines, has read a bunch of articles that are on your website, and shares Vaccine Nation and autism made in the USA with hundreds of people. He said he just wanted to thank you for questioning his views, and he is trying to share what he's learned here on this show with as many people as possible.
That's nice.
Another quick thing is an announcement. We need volunteers who have vans to help us move some product. So if you have a van and are able to help out, please give Jessica in our office a call. Her phone number is 646-926-5432. Again, that number is 646-926-5432.
Good. What else?
Well, there was also this interesting article that was published today. It was in The Nation about how Monsanto has paid over $200,000 to have Blackwater agencies scan activist blogs and websites and places that might be commenting on what they're doing and critically observing what they're doing. And I wanted to know, Gary, your thoughts on it. How do you think that impacts people and our freedom to question companies that are, out there and potentially hurting consumers?
Not potentially hurting consumers. When you see the film footage that we have finished filming in India very recently, and you see that over 175,000 individuals have committed suicide, most often drinking Monsanto's pesticides, because the failure of their crops, because the promises made about genetically engineered Monsanto cotton being a failure, then you realize we're talking about nothing that is simply benign, but very, very lethal. We are probably the leading challengers to Monsanto in genetic engineering as far as total number of people coming to a site and looking at the articles. We have, about 40 articles up there?
Mm-hmm.
Showing the dangers of genetically modified crops and the fraud of the food safety bill, and the fact that a former Monsanto executive, Michael Taylor, was appointed by Obama, again, all neocon, right down the line. Every single appointment he's made has been neocon, ultra-radical. That's what's interesting. When the right calls Obama left, and he is in every one of his policies, he was beholden to the insurance industry. He was beholden to Wall Street. He was beholden to the energy cartel, to Big Agra. Never once did he support the local organic farmer. Never once did he support complementary alternative medicine. Never once did he support green energy, like putting money behind solar and wind. Instead, he gave the money to clean coal, an oxymoron, and solar, and nuclear. And he's continued to support the war. So at some point, you have to get out of this idea of being propagandized and look at the truth. In any case, so we have shown that Monsanto is a criminal company. It's been found guilty, and it's paid hundreds of millions of dollars in fines. And it's still allowed access to policy making. It actually makes policy. So now they have hired this really creepy company, Blackwater, these private black op operation guys who work with the CIA and dirty tricks groups to look into the backgrounds of anyone critical of Monsanto. That shouldn't surprise us, because we've seen the same kind of actions on behalf of the pharmaceutical companies. Anyone that threatens their image is going to be a target. And I don't mind being a target. you know, they want to take us on, let them take us on. We're still standing, we're going to be standing, and we're going to continue to say the truth. In fact, if anything, it just allows people to understand that when you're a tiny little insignificant spot in the world, as we are, and we're able to create some fear on behalf of Monsanto because we have tens of millions of people looking at the articles and sharing them, then that means that more people are going to get the truth out. Now, thank God for the internet, because if this was mainstream media, Monsanto can control all mainstream media. You'll never get your voice heard on mainstream media. Never. But in the internet, they don't control it yet. They're trying. They may, but not yet. So we'll continue to write articles, and they also know that I'm filming a documentary. And time and again, in fact, on three times in one film trip, I saw the same person in the background, and I'm quite sure it was one of these individuals. Who were we filming? What were they saying? How could that impact them if it came out in a feature film?
Thanks, Gary. Do we have time for one last more?
One last question. Yeah.
All right. Well, this one, you know, is a little bit more topical because it has to do with the elections that just took place. And the Tea Party, you know, pulled out some victories. And a while ago, you were talking about, you know, the disenfranchised people and how, you know, they're forming their own group and they're creating their own voice. And so instead of, you know, being mocked and being ridiculed, they're out there, they're voting, and they're winning. And my question from you, Gary, is, you know, where do we go from here, and what did that election last night show us?
Well, there is no such thing as a Tea Party. There's over 1,000 Tea Party groups out there. And the right will try to make it seem as if the conservatives are now back in power, and the conservative agenda will then re-regulate the Republicans to get back in line. That's a myth. The Democrats will say, oh, thank goodness, a bunch of nut job, wackaloon, racist, white, we're insecure about our future identity, individuals are showing how loony they are, and they'll be easily defeated. Big mistake. First and foremost, there is no one ideology or political background or belief in any of these people. And had the Democrats or liberals, or for that matter, the independents and progressives, had they actually taken the time to see what people's real and authentic needs and concerns were, and then try to create policies that would not compromise on principle and offer them up with some guidance, then you could have a tsunami of positive change. Because what most people want is they simply want change. These are people who want to see the economy stabilized, they want to see jobs returned, and they also want to see people who are accountable. They don't like the Democrats or Republicans. And yet there are those like Sarah Palin and others that will, in occasions, get themselves into the political mix. But don't confuse those opportunists who do get into the political mix with a larger, overarching anger that is out there in America. I've mentioned it many times that most of the people in the media and most of the people in the democratic process are in the upper mobile educated class, or they are in the white collar class, and they've forgotten about what it is to be a blue collar worker who is suffering. Either they're working but have no money and are under water in their mortgages and in debt, and or they are not working and are apathetic and depressed and virtually bankrupt or homeless. Now, you add those two groups together, you're dealing with 200 million people, and about 170 million people. Neither of those groups is anyone paying attention to. So from those groups, people are looking for any way that they can express their concern and anger about how government, local, state, and national, is being run. They don't all have the same beliefs, but they all believe they have something legitimate in their concerns. And therefore, it would be important to be understanding, see what they're complaining about, and see what can be done to help them. instead of denigrating them or trying to use them. And that's what's happening. From the right, they're trying to exploit it. From the left, they're trying to demean them. They both do so at their own risk. Because what is happening is the majority of the people calling themselves teabaggers are actually independent. Many of them are old Republican Democrats, I should say Reagan Democrats, and or Clinton Democrat, because Clinton and Hillary and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama are nothing more than Reagan Democrats, what we now call Blue Dog Democrats. They're corporatists, because every one of their policies, everything they've done, everything was corporate. And that whole ruling elite of Democrats are corporatists. And even those who speak for them, the majority of those who speak for them on the media are corporatists. Now, they can have their own unique voice on different constructs, but look what they cover almost every day. The same material that Republicans are covering, just they're covering it from the left. And that's unfortunate, because the real thing, like, who's covering the environment? There, neither one is. Who's covering what causes us to become sick? No one's covering it. Who's covering what we should do to help our elderly and our young people and improve the quality of our education so people actually get an education that helps them in this world, not just how to test out into a school to get, you know, a higher grade to get out of school and get into a better college? No one. Who's helping stop the taking away our freedom of choice, whether it's in a vaccine or in taking a supplement, or eating organic produce? No one. Which of the Democrats and Republicans are supporting organic farming? How about neither? Which one's supporting Monsanto? How about both? Which one's supporting the health care of minorities? No one. So when you look at the actual issues, a person's health, their job, the health of their family, the quality of their neighborhood, who's helping them? Democrats or Republicans? Neither. So I've said it before and I'll say it again. Keith Olbermann will look back at some point and hopefully he has enough humility left in him to acknowledge that his attacks, without actually going out and speaking with people, have caused them to be alienated. So they're going to go against the Democrats simply because they have been spat upon. And if the only ones they have left are Republicans or conservatives within the Republicans, then that will be the next voting cycle. But I'm saying behind that voting cycle will come the next movement, meaning progressives coming from independents. You can't be a progressive till you're first independent. And you can't be independent till you first realize the limitations of being either Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal. You have to be able to where you're going to look for the truth no matter where the truth is. And once you see the truth, no matter where it is, then you say, okay, that's a truth. Like, I look at the truth of big government, and I see that big government does not make it better government. I want effective government. Therefore, I have taken an honest, scholarly look, and I see we could reduce the size of our government by 50%, state, local, and national. That saves us over $1 trillion a year. Therefore, throwing money at a problem does not solve it. Creating a bigger bureaucracy does not solve the problem. So you have to look at the truth wherever it's at. And then, but it has to be point for point for point. Does eating a health food make you healthier, or eating a sick food make you healthier? Now, if you're going to be poor and you can't afford to be sick, which makes more sense? To eat bad foods and get sick, and when you can't afford your illness, then complain, or eat good foods to prevent the illness to minimize the opportunity of getting sick. I mean, you have to look at every single issue by itself as an independent, and then what progressive means is simple. You want to see reform and change in what doesn't work until it does work. And that's the next step. And so we will be a whole cycle away before the Chris Hedges and the Gerald Salantes and all the other thousands of true independent progressive thinkers have worked together with the constitutionalists and the Greens and the Peace Party and all the other groups who now are not working together to say, now we start from the ground up and we do things right without compromise. So we're about 4 to 6 years away from seeing it done right. So in between now and then, we just have to do the right thing as individuals, and individuals then with others, and others as groups. What are we doing? We've taken one cause right now. The cause is vaccines. It affects everybody. It doesn't matter whether you're Democrat or Republican, conservative or liberal. It's irrelevant, young or old. What's relevant is we have been told that we have no choice. They want to make it mandatory. Well, that involves our freedom of have choice. So therefore, I don't tell people you should or should not vaccinate. I've never told someone do or don't vaccinate. I say look carefully at the scientific information. Is there legitimacy in the vaccine or not legitimacy in the vaccine? If there's no legitimacy, then you should know that as a parent, as an individual. And so we have then done two multi-award-winning documentaries, Vaccine Nation and Autism Made in USA. We have written over 15 major feature original investigative reporting articles. The latest one is going up in the next 2 days. And then on Monday or Tuesday of next week, we are starting a whole new information website on that will help activists and help educated people who want to do something positive about vaccines. We will be providing them with the tools to do it. If they need an article, if they need references, they need research, we will give it to them. That does not exist now. It will. So then what happens is you start with something, you take one single issue, and you hammer it, you do it right, you do it scholarly, you do it so the average person can access it, understand it, and use it as a tool for change, and then you create coalitions. From the coalitions, you create platforms. Platforms, you create change. So in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years from now, the average person aware of this information, in all likelihood, would never think about automatically giving their kid 36 vaccines before the age of six, because they'd know there's no science to it, because we will have proven there's no science. It's all about money. It's all about power. It's all about lies and deceptions at every level. And they'll see those, and they'll document them. And so they'll have all of their rebuttal points in place with good science. That is how we have to work for the future. But we have to do that with every issue. The next thing up next week is we'll be releasing my new stimulus plan. My stimulus plan will show us how we can rebalance our budget, cut all of our taxes, eliminate property tax, eliminate inheritance tax, eliminate capital gains taxes, have one small flat tax at the state level, the federal level, and a sales level, and therefore keep the majority of what we make and balance the budget within 3 years. Zero debt. Wipe out $13 trillion in debt. Is it possible? Yes, it is. Not now, it's not, but knowing it can be gives us something to work towards. So we're going to work on one issue at a time and get it right. That's what progressives do. Don't get distracted by the arguments of the left, the radicals, the right, the radicals, the conservatives, the Democrats, Republicans. Those are all distracting at this moment, and none of them have solutions that are valid. Hope that answers your question.
Thanks, Gary.
Okay. We're going to go to our guests in just about 60 seconds here, but people were asking me, would we give a inexpensive premium, and I said, you bet. So here we are. Today, you're going to get three things. You're going to get the aloe oatmeal soap that I invented. It is a wonderful soap. It is then our clean teeth toothpaste and a bottle of the Oral Pleasure mouthwash. You're getting all that as a fundraiser for this station for just $19.95. Plus your shipping and handling. And that's it, $19.95. That's a phenomenal value. By the way, in my aloe oatmeal soap, there's a non-tallow vegetable base. It is vegan with aloe vera gel, oat bran, and vitamin E. And the toothpaste, there's no sugar, there's no saccharin, there's no, like in Tom's, there's no fluoride, there's no artificial flavors, no, none of that, no. And it has natural whitening power. It's the best oral hygiene formula I have ever created. And one of the dentists who tested said it was the best. And you're getting none of the synthetic preservatives, no sodium lauryl sulfate, no chemical whiteners you get in your others. What do you get? You're getting the best. Calcium carbonate, baking soda, vegetable glycerin, silica, myrrh, guar, peppermint oil, anise oil, methyl crystals, eucalyptus oil, clove oil, xylitol, echinacea, organic green tea oil, aloe vera gel, calendula, bloodroot, bee propolis, grapefruit seed extract. That's Oral Pleasure. 16 ounces, a big jar, lasts you for months. And then take a look at your gums, take a look what it does to the bacterial bat, and most importantly, your bad breath. And there's nothing like it anywhere. So, anyhow, it's and the clean teeth, you bet. We put the best of the best in there. So you're getting all the best natural ingredients in the mouthwash, the toothpaste, and the soap. Give a call now for, it's only $19 for all three of those. I've never offered it at that little price ever. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Let's go over now and say hello to Charles Brown, president of the World Alliance for Mercury-Free Dentistry and the National Council for the Consumers for Dental Choice, which is a nonprofit group created by consumer advocates and scientists and dentists and victims poisoned by dental mercury amalgams. And he is currently the most, probably the strongest voiced advocate for dental consumer protection out there. Nice to have you with us today, Charles. Do we have Charles on the line? Oh, he was there just a second ago. Let's see if we can get him back. Hi, Charles.
Charlie Brown here.
Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, Gary, it's great to be with you, man.
Charles, I'm going to give you a few questions and just run with it, okay?
Great.
We've been led to believe by our dentists, the American Dental Association, by the FDA, the CDC, U.S. Public Health Service, that dental fillings are safe, that they don't release any mercury in the mouth, and that it's all nonsense to want to get them out. Well, I'd like for you to take us through your research to show us how you would challenge their position.
Well, Gary, I'm happy to do it. And first, let me thank you for continuing to raise issues of real issues of public health. The fact that the toxins have become so omnipresent and that the organized medicine, drug, dentistry interest groups are continuing to add toxins rather than be the fighters in our favor against toxins. We know how toxic mercury is. Everybody knows how toxic mercury is. It's the most toxic heavy metal. It's poisonous. And we're taking it out of one product after another. The Environmental Protection Agency, who certainly does not see the world like the Food and Drug Administration or the Centers for Disease Control, points out that one American woman in seven of childbearing age is so toxic with mercury, she's at risk of having a brain-damaged child. So any additional mercury to women of childbearing age, I mean, one in seven is enough to say it should be, we just got to protect them all, because we can't separate out one in seven. It's just way too huge a number. We've got to protect all young women from mercury exposure, any additional exposure, and amalgam is a mercury exposure. Nobody doubts that. The Food and Drug Administration's in the pocket of the dental interests of the American Dental Association. And when I say that, I want to make clear that the American Dental Association is only a faction of dentistry. They are the pro-mercury faction. There are thousands of dentists who have said, no, I won't use mercury fillings. I will not put my staff at risk. I will not put the public at risk. Keep in mind, amalgam, and this is not denied, is a major workplace risk for the dental workers. Amalgam is a huge contributor to the environment. So even if it were safe, which it clearly is not, it is not something we should be putting into our environment or allowing the women and men who work in dental offices to be exposed to this horrible vapor.
All right, but let's go now through the specifics. Show us the research, back up your statements with good proof about mercury is an environmental pollutant, mercury that is hazardous, for example, to female dental workers, mercury as far as social justice. These are important issues. You've got a forum now. Make your best arguments.
I'm very happy to do it. The Sierra Club, the Mercury Policy Project, a number of environmental groups issued a report, and a quantitative environmental report, said there is more mercury in our mouths than in all products combined. And if that mercury comes out in equal portions over the next 15 years, as it will as people have it removed, as they pass away, that just all the factors cremated, if it comes out in equal portions over the next 15 years, it's more mercury going into the environment than from power plants. Dentists are the number one contributors of mercury to the wastewater. They are not only are they passing on the toxins, they're passing on the cost. The taxpayers are the suckers. Amalgam is the highest priced dental filling material when we account the externalized cost, the cost to the environment, the cost to human health, and the cost to environment, to the other creatures of this planet and nation. And that gets us to the two-tiered dentistry issue, Gary. The NAACP witness before Congress said dentistry is two-tiered in this country. mercury for the poor, choice for the rich. All of us got amalgam in my time growing up. Not anymore. The rich, the elite, they don't get mercury fillings anymore. Mercury fillings are given to the men and women in our armed services. They're the main filling at the Indian Health Service. They're given to jail, people in jail and prisons. They're given in the inner cities in Appalachia, where I used to live. Those are the people now getting, the working families of America are the ones getting the mercury exposure. And since the elite don't get it, frankly, the FDA doesn't care. The FDA is the elite in this country. They are at a stopping point between revolving doors. Remember, Margaret Hamburg is the came to the FDA through the revolving door from the largest seller of mercury amalgam in the country, Henry Schein, Inc. She was a director. She got millions of dollars. She agreed to sell her stock and stock options, but didn't. Agreed not to work on the rule, but did. And after the rule was completed, the general counsel of Henry Schein, 48 hours later, and on her private email, not her public one, said to Margaret Hamburg that Henry Schein, Inc. is indebted to you for your work at FDA, indebted to you. This is the chief lawyer of Henry Schein, and this private email correspondence that Margaret Hamburg continued to have after she became the commissioner of FDA. She never stopped protecting her benefactor, Henry Schein, Inc. That's the kind of government we have at FDA. And I will say FDA is so dead set in protecting the mercury amalgam that they are going opposite to the President of the United States and to the Environmental Protection Agency. President Obama, and there was a great article in the Huffington Post about that, said that it said he's against mercury products. He's written laws about it. He sent the United States to negotiate a treaty on mercury, and we're working on that, and that's in process now in all aspects of mercury. But FDA says, nope, our interest is the dental manufacturers. They have a chief dentist doing the policy, and they have a commissioner that came straight through the revolving door. So that's an issue. There are studies as well on the worker issues. The dental workers, the women, have a lower fecundity rate, less ability to get pregnant. That's a study. They have more reproductive failures. A dentist in Canada just told me about a study that their risk of reproductive failures is greater than smokers or drug users. Do the dentists care? No, they don't care, the dentists who use mercury fillings, because if they protected their dental workers as they should, the dental workers would be dressed in all this garb. And then the patient would come in and say, doctor, why is your dental worker look, why does she look like an astronaut? And when the dentist says, well, but doctor, did you say mercury? Is that what you just said? Why is there mercury in this office? So dentists are so anxious to make those quick and easy profits with the amalgam, and that's why they still do it, not for the public, for themselves, for their profits. They are so interested in those profits that they put their own workers at risk and don't even protect them as anybody does when mercury is used in an industrial setting.
So what do you suggest people do at this point as far as getting rid of the mercury fillings in their mouth?
In their mouth, they better get medical and dental advice. I mean, there's no question about that. Our group, and Consumers for Dental Choice, is not a health group. We're an education and advocacy group, and we want the end of mercury fillings going in. Each one getting out, because it's a very important procedure. It's a difficult procedure. There's mercury exposure. People have gotten brutally ill from the removal. So the removal has to be done by a mercury-free dentist following protocol and carefully. And you've got to juice up your body with vitamins. I mean, I'm juice up, but you get the right vitamin C and so on to protect your body when the procedure starts. So we don't at all advocate wholesale and quick removal of the amalgam. We do advocate an end to amalgam absolutely immediately and an end to the profiteering by the amalgam manufacturers and the dentists that have decided to keep doing this, and their faction supporter, the American Dental Association.
Okay. I appreciate you bringing this to our attention, Charlie. Give your organization's email address.
I will, Gary. Consumers for Dental Choice, and our website is toxicteeth.org, and I was so glad to hear you speak at the New Jersey State House in Trenton a couple of years ago. It helped remove a governor from office who didn't care if mercury went into every child in the state by vaccines, and you're fighting the good fight.
Back in a moment. That was Charles Brown, our guest. Now a commentary from Michael Moore of michaelmoore.com. Michael Moore blames Iraq war on liberals and the New York Times. I'm quoting from Michael Moore. I've known we've been free of Iraq for 2 weeks now, and our minds have turned to the new football season and Fashion Week in New York. And now, well, it's exciting that the new fall TV season is just a day or two away. But before we get too far from something we would all just like to forget, will you please allow me just to say something plain and blunt and necessary? We invaded Iraq because most Americans, including good liberals like Al Friedman, Franken, Nicholas Kristof, and Bill Keller of the New York Times, David Remnick of the New Yorker, and editors of the Atlantic and the New Republican, Harvey Weinstein, Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, and John Kerry wanted to. Of course, the actual blame for the war goes to Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, because they ordered the precision bombing, the invasion, the occupation, and the theft of our national treasury. I have no doubt that history will record that they committed the undisputed crime of the young century. And how did they get away with it, considering they had lost the presidential elections by 543,000 votes? They also knew that the majority of the country probably wouldn't back them in such a war. A Newsweek poll in October 2002 reported 61% thought it was very important for Bush to get formal approval from the United Nations for war, but that never happened. So how did they pull it off? They did it by getting liberal voices to support their war. They did it by creating the look of bipartisanship, and they convinced other countries like Tony Blair to get on board and make it all like it was it was the intelligence agencies giving them the proof. But most importantly, they made this war and its public support happen because Bush and company had brilliantly conned the New York Times into running a bunch of phony front-page stories about how Saddam Hussein had all these weapons of mass destruction. The administration gleefully fed this false information not to Fox News or Washington Times. They gave it to America's leading liberal newspaper. They must have had a laugh riot each morning when they picked up the New York Times and read the nearly word-for-word scenarios and talking points they had concocted in the vice president's office. I blame the New York Times more for this war than Bush. I expected Bush and Cheney to try and get away with what they did, but the Times and the rest of the press was supposed to stop them from doing their job, be a relentless watchdog of government and business, and then inform the public so we can take action. Instead, the New York Times gave the Bush administration the cover they needed. They could and did say, hey, look, even the Times says Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. With this groundwork laid, the Bush crowd ended up convincing a whopping 70% of the public to support the war, a public that had given him less than 40% of its vote in 2000. Early liberal support for this war was the key ingredient in selling it to a majority of the public. I realize this is something no one in the media nor most of us really wants to discuss. As an aside, by the way, Mike, I did 41 programs prior to the invasion of why the war was a fraud and why the person who is feeding the information to Judith Mill at the New York Times had been discredited by German intelligence and even the CIA. So, no, there were those of us in the media, Mike, who were right on the story, ahead of the story. Not all of us, but we were. Quote, who among us want to feel the pain of having to remember that liberals, by joining with Bush, made this war happen? Please, before our collective memory fades, I just want us to be honest with ourselves and present an unsanitized version of how they pulled off this war. I can guarantee you the revisionists will make sure the real truth will never enter the history books. Children born when the war began started second grade this month. Kids who were 11 in 2003 are now old enough to join up and get killed in Iraq in a non-combatant capacity. They'll never understand how we got here if we don't. So let me state this clearly. This war was aided and abetted by liberals who were afraid to stick their necks out and thus remain silent, by liberals who actually said they believed Colin Powell's cartoon presentation at the UN and then went against their better judgment by publicly offering their support for the invasion of Iraq. First, there were those 29 turncoat Democrat senators who voted for the war. Then there was the embarrassing display of reporters who couldn't wait to be embedded and go for a joyride on a Bradley tank. But my real despair lies with the people I counted on for strong opposition to this madness, but who left the rest of us alone, out on a limb, and we tried to stop the war. In March 2003, to a public figure speaking out against the war was considered instant career suicide. Take the Dixie Chicks, Exhibit A. Their lead singer, Natalie Mames, uttered just one sentence of criticism, and their career was effectively dead and buried at that moment. Bruce Springsteen spoke out in their defense, and a Colorado DJ was fired for refusing not to play their songs. That was about it. Crickets everywhere else. The then MSNBC fired the only nightly critic of the war, the television legend Phil Donahue. No one at the network, or any network, spoke up on his behalf. There would never again be a Phil Donahue show. Little did GE know that when they soon filled the 8 p.m. hour with a sports guy named Keith Urban, they would end up with the war's most brilliant and fiercest critic night after night after night. There were a few others, Bill Maher, Janine Carfalo, Tim Robbins, Seymour Hersh, who weren't afraid to speak the truth, but where was everyone else? Where were all those supposed liberal voices in the media? Instead, this is what we were treated to back in 2003 and 2004. Al Franken, who said, quote, he reluctantly was a supporter of the war against Saddam Hussein. And 6 months later, he was still saying, quote, there were reasons to go to war in Iraq. Nicholas Kristof, columnist from the New York Times, who attacked me and wrote a column comparing me to the nutty right-wingers who claimed Hillary and had Vince Foster killed, he said people like me were, quote, polarizing the political cesspool. And then Hal Raines, editor-in-chief of the liberal New York Times, who was, according to the Times former editor, quote, eager to have articles that supported the warmongering out of Washington. And Bill Keller, The New Yorker, and others. So, okay, Michael Moore, I appreciate what you've said. You said the right thing at the right time. Just to remind the liberals about their participation in the war in Iraq, and which also extends now to the war in Afghanistan and the war in Pakistan. Thank you. I'm Gary Nall. Next up, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, a man whose show is ever gaining in popularity, Mike Fader with The Turning Point. The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee. Come on, go, can you sing it? Oh, man, I'm never see, come on.